writers, there has been a concern not only about sexuality in general, but particularly as it applies to adolescents and probably girls in particular. So young adult novels, YA novels, have always been disproportionately targeted. And you know, when the internet was new, Steve, you will remember the ACLU, I'm so proud, brought and won a historic lawsuit against the law that swept through Congress almost immediately with almost no debate and almost nobody voting against it, which would have outlawed on the internet all indecent or patently offensive expression. So the internet would have been reduced to the same low common denominator that still applies to broadcast, over-the-air broadcast. The ACLU successfully challenged it on behalf of a broad group of mainstream publishers, as well as human rights organizations and so forth. But the impetus for that law was supposedly for the sake of minors. We have to shield young people from indecent, patently offensive, sexually themed speech. There seems to be this assumption that the information and expression is inherently dangerous to them. At least some of the judges, as that case wound its way through the courts, some of the judges accepted our arguments that not only do young people have their own free speech rights, which includes the right to receive information and ideas, but this sexually oriented expression was often health-saving and life-saving for them. Kids that were living in isolated communities at the time, being gay was much more stigmatized than it is now. They had nobody they could talk to in their own physical geographical community to be able to get information and to build community online. Given the epidemic of suicide among gay youth, this was absolutely life-saving. Or at the time we had, you know, severe spreads of STDs among young people. To get information about safer sex and STDs, again, could be health and even life-saving. So, you know, we say that we're doing this to protect the children, but it actually is depriving them of liberty and also reducing their health and their life positivity.
Nadine, this has been an extraordinary conversation. What steps do you think listeners can take if they want to increase support for free speech?
Number one, know what your own free speech rights are and exercise them in order to staunchly, consistently, even-handedly defend freedom of speech for other people. Please remember the golden rule of free speech. We cannot have freedom for the speech we love unless we also are willing to defend freedom for the speech we loathe.
Thank you, Nadine. It's been an illuminating hour with you. I appreciate today and I appreciate everything you do every day to protect civil liberties.
Right back at you, Steve. Thanks so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to this week's edition of Ebony Spectrum. First up, we got Lene, and then we have more.
Florida, it's been a minute now, but once again, we on your ass. A nonprofit organization by the name of Hope and Help Center of Central Florida is under fire for discrimination, racism, and retaliatory actions against its marginalized employees. And what's wild, but not unexpected in the slightest, is that while they out here behaving like this to said marginalized employees, the org's mission requires direct interaction with vulnerable, underserved, and marginalized populations every day. Y'all remember our lovely substitute teacher at the Eric Lewis? Well, he's the one blowing this whistle, as up until a couple weeks ago, he himself was an employee at Hope and Help until he was wrongfully terminated for simply sticking up for himself and his coworkers in the face of good old boyism. Now, Eric used to serve as the syringe exchange linkage and volunteer coordinator at an org whose mission is to end the HIV and STI epidemic in Florida through comprehensive health education prevention, testing, and treatment. In his TikTok videos chronicling the ways in which he and others were systemically ousted from the organization, Eric runs down a list of infractions ranging from unprofessional to straight up racist and discriminatory. A member of leadership who was white walked up to Eric talking about, "Where's your master?" Referring to his non-black supervisor. "I know you lying." Talking about, "Ooh, are you scared of the chain link fence?" In what world are these words coming out your mouth in the workplace? Anita Nunez, a Latinx trans woman who was basically forced to resign, was misgendered purposefully over and over again by a seasoned employee, a custodian with a 35-year tenure who knew he had to face zero consequences for his harassment. And when Anita went to HR about her mistreatment, asking for protection, HR backed the custodian by pulling out a Pope keychain. Claiming that the janitor cited religious beliefs as the reason he couldn't properly gender her. Boy, I tell you. But wait, there's more. Another co-worker attended a pro-Palestine protest during her pre-approved paid time off, minding her own damn revolutionary business in plain clothes. But somehow, when she returned back to work, she received a final written notice of warning for her conduct outside of the workplace, even though she had never received any warnings for anything prior to this incident. But somehow, other people at the job had been vocal in their support for Israel in a company-wide group chat, and not only did they not face any consequences, but the executive director and HR was in there liking the messages. Now, the reason Eric was fired is because he came with receipts, screenshots, and documentation, voicing kids and recently terminated employees' concerns. He sent a message about it to that same group chat, but he was kicked out. And after trying to receive support from HR and handle all this internally, Eric was terminated and treated like a threat to security and discarded. A person who cares about the work that they do, discarded from a program whose leaders are happy to turn away patients, happy to change the locks on the food pantry, and apparently got enough time on their hands to surveil the personal social media accounts of their employees and their in-house communications. And you can go watch the videos on the socials for yourself, and you should to see how you can help. But what you'll see throughout is this boys club mentality and nepotism that left Eric and his co-workers completely vulnerable to their leadership's personal loyalties, affinities, and politics. Y'all watching season 6 of Love is Blind? You seen when asked about her politics, that girl said she was a patriot. Goodness gracious. But that she felt that politics didn't belong in most conversations. Huh? She also added that she only preferred to discuss her politics with like-minded people. Y'all, we simply cannot live like that. I don't know who lied to you or wanted to make it easier for you to believe that lie, that politics are restricted to the voting booths, but no. What happened to Eric and the people at Hope and Help is a walking, talking demonstration of how personal politics bleed into every facet of the everyday lives of everyday people. And now more than ever, Eric lives in Florida. And while I've heard the Floridians are banding together communally to combat the anti-black and anti-queer assaults from the people who currently hold their political seats, wherever political corruption is the norm or maladaptive beliefs are all but ubiquitous, it becomes increasingly more difficult for people like Eric to be protected. And unfortunately, these kinds of hostile work environments are not uncommon in nonprofits. For a sector where everybody is supposed to have the understanding that it's not about the money, the hostility is very much centered around the prospect of money, often funded by individual donations and grants from corporations and or government entities. Even for the most well-meaning nonprofit professionals, it can be difficult to focus on their mission and the people they seek to serve with integrity. Why? Because they are ultimately beholden to the values of said donors. In 2020, the nonprofit sector lost roughly 1.6 million jobs due to COVID. This meant that the need for nonprofit services increased exponentially while jobs, donations, and grant opportunities decreased dramatically. And in a lose-lose situation like that, it becomes easier to see how the survival of a nonprofit in an underserved community becomes dependent on the board and its major donors. And when big money comes into play, so too do the political allegiances and personal ideologies of the people who have it. And it doesn't stop there. The historically low salaries in the public sector stem from the fact that the only money coming in are from donations and grant funding, meaning that wages are low, teams are small, and everyone someone is meant to overwork while underpaid in the name of meeting the mission. However, more often than not, the higher up in nonprofits you go, the wider and wealthier it gets. Where the administrators and coordinators tend to reflect the populations of the organizations that they serve, the directors, chief officers, and board members, well, simply do not. And it's the boards on these committees that are the ones approving the high salaries for the executive leadership. Now, H&H is the only syringe exchange in the state of Florida, so Eric and friends do not want to see it topple. They want to see it transformed. This means out with the old, in with the new. So the people who give a damn about people more than they do appearances can do what they need to do.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reasoned Choice Media.
Welcome home, everybody. This is Angela Rye with Tiffany Cross and Andrew Gillum. Yo. Today, we're doing a mini pod, and we are talking about Terrence Howard on his hustle and flow. The hustle was trying not to pay $900 in taxes. $900,000 in taxes, damn near $1 million. And the flow was, I kind of like this part. He said, you know what? I don't think as black people who are descendants of slaves, we should have to pay this shit. I agree with this.
I'm not mad at it either.
I agree with this part. But good luck with him staying out of jail. We was just talking about jail.
That's the thing. The IRS really just wants their money. Like, for people the people who end up going to jail, it is really like a double middle finger to them, where it's like, I'm just not going to pay you. But I think the larger question of, when you consider the wealth that black people created for this country, from the rice to the sugar cane to the cotton, we made this here country a superpower.
Yes.
And the South was its wealthiest region, because that is where most of the enslaved were working. And we have never been repaid. We've never had any reparations. We've never seen the benefit of any of that work. As Angela coined the phrase, we built this joint for free. So, you know, on the surface, this sounds like, oh, a kind of silly thing from Terrence Howard. But when you get into it, this brother is making a legitimate point. Yeah. I don't know how we would make this happen, but I would be completely down for some sort of policy that says, yes, you are exempt from paying taxes.
We would have liked to hear Joe Biden say in the State of the Union address that he's going to give black people an evergreen tax credit where we never have to pay taxes.
I will say that he would not win re-election with that.
That would be the nail in the coffin.
What about Donald Trump?
Did you see what we just did?
Yeah, you guys just did a thing.
We just said we don't like the whisper.
We just eliminated our imagination.
Yes.
Yeah.
We know them too well.
No, we came down on the side of practical and political and politically reasonable.
Pragmatism. Because we know the other side too well.
Because we know the other side too well. But should knowing the other side and their objection be enough to stop the demand? And
no,
Terrence Howard says, no. You know, you may think that we're past this, but I'm still hanging on to the 40 acres and a mule. And since y'all didn't come to pass with that, now the land seems to be taken up, or it's bad land, or it's good land that you gave to black folks when you thought it was bad land, and now you're coming back to retake it.
Hello, Miami.
Yeah.
But I will say, I just... What happened to homeboy Wesley Snipes? Did he go to jail?
He went to jail.
You know, I'm so glad you bring this up. Because I got something on this.
I don't know. I just don't
want to. He went to prison.
He did. And here's the thing. That's what I was just about to ask. I was literally sitting here like, you know, I can only think of tax evasion cases where black people are criminally prosecuted. I can't think of no white folks. Can y'all?
Honestly, it could be because I don't pay that much attention. Like, when something happens with Wesley Snipes or Terrence Howard, like, it lands in my feed, I see it.
Donald Trump didn't pay no damn taxes.
How about that?
That's a really
I just pulled up this piece that says tax evasion by millionaires and billionaires tops $150 billion a year, says IRS chief. And I am curious to know how many of those tax evaders get criminally prosecuted, get their wages garnished, and ever have to do time in prison. I can only think of black folks.
I might be wrong. I'd like to be proven wrong.
So
do we wonder why the top 1% could, by any reasonable, rational notion, be sitting in the Donald Trump camp today? Well, you got to conclude that Donald Trump and the Republicans inside Congress.
Trump. I love that he said Donald Trump.
Slip of the tramp tongue. But he and the Republicans in Congress have stood up against the IRS, have threatened to zero fund it, have threatened to slow walk the money that was approved during COVID, where Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats said, well, we're going to go after the cheats and those who don't pay their taxes. They enumerated this. And Donald Trump said, no, we need to get rid of the IRS. And he was not by himself. He had the majority of the Republican leadership in the House who said, no, I'm only bringing this, pulling back the layer, y'all, because you asked the question and it's the right question to be asked, that when we make the statement that in a principle wanted that, that, nah, you owe me, I don't owe you. Nobody is over here explaining from members of Congress or from Donald Trump why it is that they hold the position that they hold and why those folks are never, ever held accountable. We shouldn't be surprised.
It's not surprising, but honestly, if we could just take it out of the minutiae of politics for a second and the practicality of what it looks like for us. You and I have talked about this. Our money in our industry is sometimes very clunky. And so sometimes you will get a big lump sum check. And I know what we talked about in our podcast this week about the payroll we inherit when you get money, where mama needs, brother needs, nephew needs, sister needs, cousin needs, auntie needs, and you're paying out everybody. So if I get a lump sum check, let's just say to keep it for easy figures, $100,000, and technically maybe I owe the government $45,000 of that, because once you get to states, and sometimes our work is in different states. So if I've spoken in Indianapolis, if I've spoken in Los Angeles, if I've spoken in Miami, I owe all those places taxes from when I spoke. I don't know. All I'm getting is this big lump sum, and I'm looking at my bills and everything. And guess what I'm saying? To hell with the IRS. I have these bills to pay right now.
Right.
And that is what is in front of me right now. That's the most urgent thing. It doesn't. I literally did not know. Well, how do I just call up the IRS and say, hey, I got this check. I might owe y'all some money. I don't know how to do it. Yeah. Like, there is no guidelines to that. And so in the entertainment industry, particularly with Terrence Howard, I can see how you're getting these big lump sums of money and you don't know really how to manage it. That's why some people have business managers. But sometimes business managers is an expense you
cannot
afford.
That's an accountant or CPA for folks who don't earn in the same
thank
industry.
You. Yeah. But you, I mean, I can't technically afford a business manager right now. You know, somebody that's telling me how to spend my money. But those are the people who can step in for you. So I actually feel really bad for entertainers who find themselves in that space. I feel bad for me who has found myself in that space.
I just think if we have to pay ours and they're on our neck about getting their money from us, then be that on the neck of the well. I mean, the folks who got who are underpaying their taxes or not paying taxes at all, Donald Trump,
some
who could
of them
inflate,
haven't filed since 2017. Yeah. This new bureau is kind of going after them.
Or you've done some BS like Donald Trump, where you have valued your business at one level to get financing from a bank.
Yeah.
But when it comes to them paying on
the
that great big wealth
it's
you built,
$5.
All of a sudden, it ain't worth nothing. So all I'm saying is, what's good for the goose ought to be good for the gander. Until Terrence Howard is able to help us move this country forward around reparations in association with taxation, pay your taxes.
But we understand the frustration.
But we understand the heat. We understand it. But to the government, go after the folks who ain't. Spend some time, energy, effort going after the folks who are
cheats. The billionaires and the trillionaires. Like, I also just think from a practical standpoint, like if we were just talking about efficiency, like is it really worth it just to have the example of someone who has a big name to collect this small check when you have people who are not paying millions and billions of dollars in taxes?
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't even seem like a smart strategy.
Yeah.
If the government is owed money, go where you can get the biggest hit.
You
it's
heard,
not $900,000.
You heard Warren Buffett say it. He said, my secretary should not be paying a greater percentage of her earnings and taxes than I pay in mine.
Yeah.
This is Warren Buffett, right?
Yeah.
And thankfully, he's made the giving pledge. But if y'all just charge them more, right? I think that's fair. I think
some
most
of
people,
them haven't filed since 2017.
But some of them have defrauded the system.
That's true, too.
They ain't going to pay, and nobody is going to go after them. Terrence Howard is an exception here. I'm not calling him a millionaire, but if he is a millionaire, he's an exception within the millionaire class that the taxing authority is going after him trying to collect, because they didn't do that to Donald Trump. And I'll rest my case on him.
And those wealthy people have been dealing with these kind of things for decades. like some of us, this is very new to us, you know, like we're just in the past 5-10 years just figuring this out, just navigating this. Donald Trump's father was a millionaire. You know, a lot of these people come from family money. They have family attorneys. They have a crew of people around them.
And they have a whole bunch of tax law that has been developed
in their favor
exclusively for
very
them.
True.
So that when they pass it on, or they pass it on via stock and not in cash,
that
the rules are different. I mean, come on.
Every part of this system is designed
for
us to trip up.
And that's how they can hide in plain sight. And so with this, like this.
And a sense of the presidency.
That's it. So the Inflation Reduction Act, which was, of course, passed under the Biden administration, is how the IRS has taken on this new approach to, you know, coming after the millionaires and billionaires who have not paid their taxes or have not filed since 2017. It says that $80 billion, the IRA increased the IRS budget by $80 billion over 10 years, and most of that is designed to support with enforcement of folks who haven't paid their taxes. So it's not just the folks who kind of can cut the corners. This is like for folks who actively haven't filed, like the Terrence Howards of the world. I'm interested to see, and I hope that it doesn't happen this way, but I'm interested to see if more of the people who are targeted look like us.
Yeah.
Angela, I don't have any hope that that bureau, one, will get the resources. I think that the Republicans, so long as they stay in a negotiating or power position, are going to continue to slow walk. That's why they said zero fund the IRS, and that's why they said to slow walk this money in their direction.
This bill passed in 2022. They have this money.
Guess what? Zelensky was supposed to get that money from Trump, wasn't he?
Well,
they already
put out the releases saying that this is exactly what they're going to do.
And I'm telling you, don't hold your breath because I ain't holding mine.
I got a question. Well, as we close out, because this is our mini pod, so it's a quick topic, but I have a question for our viewers. I would like to hear you all weigh in. Should Black people have to pay taxes?
I like this question.
I want to hear what y'all have to say.
So
weigh in, drop a comment. We know your answer. We all got the same answer, but we want to hear from you guys.
Andrew might not. Andrew wants to.
I think people ought to pay their fair share. But I think if I have to pay my fair share, the wealthiest 1% should have to pay
theirs. Okay, let me ask you. Can we ask this a follow up to the listeners, and Andrew can answer first? What's the fair share? What percentage is a fair share to pay
that
taxes?
That 40% really sucks.
Okay, what's the fair share?
Yeah,
how much do you think you should pay?
Well, first of all, the fair share is what does it cost us to run the government of our choosing?
But should our fair share look like everyone else? Should there should it be adjusted? Is that some form of reparations? Like, okay, if you're in this tax bracket, if you are a descendant of the enslaved, then we will decrease your tax bracket
by
50%. Guess
what? If we were the wealthy 1%, they would have come up with that rule for us already.
We're in a debate, and I'm asking you the question, sir.
Yes,
what is your percentage that you want to pay?
I mean,
what had happened was,
I'm just saying.
Look at this
I feel in some ways overburdened by the current tax structure, largely because it squeezes those of us who are at the working middle to pay the lion's share of what it costs to operate the government.
What do you think is fair to pay?
Well, 10%, it's arbitrary
5%,
for me to say that because
1%.
I don't know what would this system look like if everybody paid 30%.
Do you want to know what I want to pay?
I can guess, but sure, you can say it. I'm just saying, I was a local elected official, guys. I can't be like against taxation.
Yeah, I get
taxation
it.
Taxation goes, not to mention, my kids are in public school.
Yeah.
Paid for by my taxes that I pay on my house.
See, this is why I like this part, because you get to hear like what all gets covered.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Ambulances.
But what I can't tell you
police.
Is what all gets covered federally because of what a messy mess, deliberately so, that system is. How many people don't have to pay taxes because they inherited their money or it was passed down through stock or stock? What do they do? What do they do now? They shred half the stock, the value of the stock, double it, and then you pass it on to your children and your children don't pay on that. And then your children, you got generations, 5-6 generations of wealth, and nobody in those 5 or 6 generations had to do a thing for it.
Well, speaking of children,
that's a good point.
You got to get home to your kids.
Yes,
I do.
It's a but
hard
listen,
out at
2:00. Our viewers, it's a simple, easy question. Should Black people, because these are internet comments, so we don't need your dissertation on this. Is a simple, easy question. Should Black people have to pay taxes? We want to hear from you. Weigh in.
As a form of reparations.
The yays or nays.
Andrew, you better get home to those babies.
I'm getting
Angela, can we go eat?
Yes. We
okay.
Can.
All right. Thanks
we
for joining
y'all.
Us. For
welcome
this
home.
Mini-pod.
We don't know how many days are to the election. It's a mini pod. See y'all.
We are coming off a big week in politics, but there are challenges ahead, particularly with the war between Israel and Hamas reaching a critical point as the holy month of Ramadan begins. And we turn now to that crisis in the Middle East and renewed fears of violence in Jerusalem. I do want to note that we have an extensive bipartisan conversation with the chairs of the Senate Intelligence Committee that will be coming up in a moment. But we're going to begin with Senator Bernie Sanders from Burlington, Vermont. Good morning to you, Senator.
Good morning.
You have long been a critic of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The other night, President Biden was heard on a hot mic after the State of the Union address saying he has to have a come-to-Jesus talk with Netanyahu about letting humanitarian aid into Gaza. Have you spoken to President Biden about whether he's had this conversation? If he hasn't, what is he waiting for? And if he already had it, has it made any difference?
Well, I've spoken to people very high up in his administration. Here's the bottom line. Margaret, what we are seeing in Gaza today is literally an unprecedented crisis. It's not just that 30,000 people, two-thirds of them are women and children, have already been killed. We are looking at the possibility of hundreds of thousands of children starving to death. The United States of America cannot be complicit in this mass slaughter of children. So it is one thing to talk to Netanyahu, to pressure Netanyahu, but here is the bottom line. Year after year, we have provided billions of dollars in military aid to the government of Israel. Right now, you have a right-wing extremist government under Netanyahu. There are plans to provide him with another $10 billion in unfettered military aid. Well, you can't say to Netanyahu, stop the slaughter, allow the massive amounts of humanitarian aid that we need to come in to feed the children. Please, please, please. Oh, but by the way, if you don't do it, here's another $10 billion to continue the war. Now, we have written a letter to the president. It turns out that Israel is in violation of the law. Stopping American humanitarian aid is in violation of the law. That should be clear. No more money to Netanyahu's war machine to kill Palestinian children.
You've said Israel's in violation of the Foreign Assistance Act, as have a handful of other Democratic senators. They may also be in violation of the Leahy Act. The president himself has the national security powers to suspend. Do you really think, though, in a presidential election year, that the president of the United States would halt or pause or condition aid to one of the closest allies in the Middle East?
Well, I think it is the right thing to do. You can't beg Netanyahu. You got to tell him if you want any money, you got to change your policy. Allow the trucks to come in to feed the children. And by the way, in terms of politics, which is secondary to my mind in this issue, the truth is, whether you're a conservative Republican or a progressive, you do not want to see children in Palestine starve to death. So I think it's good politics, and it's the moral and right thing to do.
Do you stand by your view that a full ceasefire with Hamas is unrealistic because that terror group seeks to destroy Israel?
Look, what you need right now is a ceasefire tomorrow so that the trucks, the massive amount of humanitarian aid can come in to feed the people who are starving. But you have Hamas is dedicated to destroying Israel, yet the Netanyahu government, which is dedicated to destroying Hamas. I think at the end of the day, Hamas cannot be continuing to run Gaza, and the Netanyahu government cannot continue to run Israel if we're going to ever bring peace to that region.
But a temporary ceasefire is sufficient for you?
To feed the children right now is what we've got to exactly do.
Okay. Yesterday, President Biden was asked about Israel's plans to launch an operation into the southern city of Rafah in southern Gaza. Listen to what he said.
Would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and you cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead.
Was that clear to you in terms of where that red line is? And what do you make of it?
Look,
Margaret, 1.7 million Palestinians, 80% of their population, have been driven from their homes and displaced. Many of them end up in Rafah. To go in there and to displace them again and start a major military campaign would be an unmitigated disaster. Mm-hmm. So my view is, of course, we cannot support an attack of that kind on Rafah. Bottom line is, though, Netanyahu has got to be told no more money for his war machine unless there is humanitarian aid coming in to feed the people.
Well, that'll be in the hands at the moment of the House of Representatives, which hasn't scheduled a vote. On the politics of this, more than 100,000 voters in Michigan went uncommitted to protest Mr. Biden's policy. In the state of Minnesota, in the recent primary there, you saw a similar boycott. Almost 20% went uncommitted. Given your moral objections, your personal issues here, can you, in good conscience, ask your supporters to vote for Mr. Biden?
Well, look, the contrast that I think President Biden made it very clear in the State of the Union address, if you believe that climate change is real, you got to vote for President Biden. If you believe that women have a right to control their own bodies, you got to vote for President Biden. If you think that at a time of massive income and wealth inequality, you don't give trillions of dollars in tax breaks to the 1%, you've got to vote for Biden. If you want to lower the cost of prescription drugs, you got to vote for Biden. If you believe in democracy and involving people in the process rather than keeping people from voting, you have to vote for Biden.
So you're saying progressives need to put this aside?
I am saying we've got to come, not put it aside. The fight continues to change Biden's policy in Gaza. But the contrast between Biden and Trump is day and night. The election of Trump would be a disaster for this country and, in my view, the world. We've got to come together, reelect Biden. But at the same time, we have to demand that we have a progressive agenda where we have an economy that works for all, not just the few.
So you're standing by your endorsement of Mr. Biden's election despite the current policy?
No, I am not supporting Mr. Trump.
Mr. Biden.
The election of Trump would be yes, that's right.
And for more news this week.
Political transition minister of Haiti, Ariel Henry, has resigned. That's according to the president of Guyana, Irfan Ali, who is the chairman of the Caribbean regional group, CARICOM. Henry has been in Puerto Rico since last week after gang leaders who have been dominating the capital warned him against returning to Port-au-Prince. Leaders of the Caribbean bloc CARICOM have been meeting in Jamaica's capital to discuss the political transition and the security crisis in Haiti. Let's bring in Al Jazeera's Teresa Bo on the phone now from Santo Domingo in neighboring Dominican Republic. So what more are you hearing about Ariel Henry's resignation, Teresa? Was this expected?
Well, certainly pressure on him has been mounting in the past few days. What we've seen is Prime Minister Ariel Henry at the time was not able to return to his country after traveling to Kenya to meet with the Kenyan president and try to arrange the assistance by an elite force to help police officers in the country fight against the gangs that have taken controls of 80% at least of Haiti's capital back then. At the time, he was not allowed to land here in the Dominican Republic. He had to fly to Puerto Rico. He was declared a persona non grata. He was not welcome here in the Dominican Republic. And what we've been seeing is that even though the United States and other countries have been supporting him since he was designated prime minister. This happened after the assassination of former President Jovenel Moïse back in 2021. Many people in Haiti did not want him to be in power, did not believe in his capacity of getting the country out of the current crisis. I just come from being at the border with Haiti, where thousands of people cross the border every day. And everyone we spoke to said that Prime Minister Ariel Henry, or now former Prime Minister Ariel Ariely needs to resign because he's not the person that will be able to get out the country out of the crisis. And as you were mentioning, you know, this happened just after a meeting of the CARICOM of the Caribbean community happening in Jamaica. It happened just as the United States and the members of CARICOM expressed their concern about the increasing insecurity of the crisis ongoing in Haiti, them already thinking of a transition government. They're referring to as a presidential college that would be composed of political parties, of private sector, among others, to try to set up a transition that at the same time will lead the country towards free and fair elections. So certainly there's a feeling that he had lost support, not only of his people, but also of the international community. So in a way, his resignation does not come as a surprise.
Right. So a resignation that doesn't come as a surprise. If you're joining us on Al Jazeera, breaking news, the Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry, the embattled Haitian Prime Minister, has resigned this a day after a regional meeting in Jamaica, during which U.S. Secretary of State Teresa promised an additional $100 million for a UN-backed force to stabilize Haiti. The international force for Haiti has been really at the center of this crisis. The gangs in Port-au-Prince opposed to an international force. What happens now as far as that is concerned? What could happen next?
We're going to have to see what the reaction is in Port-au-Prince, also what the gangs have to say. Let's not forget that they had already been warning that if Ariel Henry was allowed to return, this would trigger a civil war. We already saw the leadership of the G9 Federation of Gangs, Jimmy Cherissier, he's also known as Barbecue, for example, warning hotel managers and hotel owners in Port-au-Prince of trying to give shelter to politicians close to Ariel Henry that could be in hiding in many hotels in the capital of Haiti. So suddenly, you know, it has an impact. You know, there's been lots of talks about the deployment of this multinational security support mission, which would be to give support to the Haitian National Police. There's been lots of talks in the past year about the deployment of this force that would be led by Kenya. This has not happened yet. There's been the United States announced that they're putting more money in to fund this whole operation, but nobody really knows when these police officers from Kenya are going to be in the ground. What we do know, for example, is that the Haitian National Police, the union, has been desperately requesting weapons, ammunition, bulletproof vests, because they're saying that they do not have the resources they need to fight against the gangs in Haiti.
Right. And this, of course, Teresa, is not the first crisis Haiti is experiencing. Ariel Henry came to power after the assassination of the former president, Jovenel Moïse. And before that, you had decades of uncertainty under previous leaders of Haiti as well. Why has this happened? What factors have contributed to this continued instability in Haiti?
Well, there is a long tradition in Haiti of politicians supporting gangs, of gangs being involved also in extortion, in politics and different things. But what we've seen is that since Jovenel Moïse was assassinated back in 2021, this is something that has increased. And what complicated the situation even more is that Ariel Henry was not an elected official. He was just handpicked at the time. And this is something that generated lots of resentment among the population, them saying that, you know, that need to be elections in Haiti. There's been lots of calls for the past years that elections need to happen, that Ariel Henry was an illegitimate leader, that election, free and fair election need to happen in Haiti. However, the big challenge now is how to carry out those elections because of the insecurity crisis that exists in Haiti, because the international community, and of course at the time Ariel Henry, were unable to control the gangs. Let me tell you, I was a year ago in Haiti, and already gangs were controlling 80% of Haiti's capital. Already you would see armed gangs, you know, very close to the airport, in different locations all around the capital, with big fights happening at the time. And it's been a year since there's been requests for this multinational force to start operating in Haiti, and this has not happened. So suddenly there's been an escalation in the past few years. There's been an inability or an incapacity by the international community at the time to pressure Henry to call for elections. And what we're seeing now is Henry's resignation and suddenly the situation in Haiti almost spiraling out of control and at risk of civil war, which is what, at the time, the CARICOM leadership is extremely concerned about.
Teresa, thank you very much for that. Teresa Ball, live there on the line from the Dominican Republic. Again, if you're just joining us, the Haitian Prime Minister, the embattled Haitian Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, has resigned. Here now is Mariana Sanchez with a look at his political career.
Anger and frustration marked the 3 years of Ariel Henry's tenure as Haiti's leader. The interim prime minister rose to power in 2021, weeks after President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated by a group of mercenaries. As a result, political groups agreed to a power-sharing deal that's set to expire this month. Henry took control of the government amidst a crippling economy and spiraling violence. In 2023, more than 4,000 Haitians were killed and another 3,000 kidnapped. In 2022, Henry survived an assassination attempt during a ceremony marking Haiti's independence. Henry promised to organize elections only after restoring security.
Several conditions are necessary to organize the elections, to realize public consultations, and to adopt a new constitution. First, we have to tackle insecurity and arrest all terrorists who attack and kidnap children and adults.
Many Haitians said the government was illegitimate, and some investigators believed Henry was involved in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, which only added fuel to the turmoil in the streets. Gangs set up roadblocks, prevented the distribution of fuel, and controlled nearly 80% of Port-au-Prince and other parts of the country. Thousands were displaced. Nearly half of the population lives under the poverty line. Haitians said Ariel Henry was unable to manage the crisis, one that it seems has no end.
Violence and chaos have erupted across Haiti's Port-au-Prince, where gangs have attacked hospitals, police stations, the airport, and more in their bid to overthrow the government. The prime minister is now in exile in Puerto Rico, and the United States has evacuated the embassy. For the Haitians left behind, the humanitarian crisis is getting worse by the day. Here in Massachusetts, a robust community of Haitian descendants, immigrants, and recent migrants are rocked by the violence. Dr. Gerald Gabot grew up in Haiti. She's now executive director of the Boston-based Immigrant Family Services Institute, which supports immigrants and migrants from Haiti. Dr. Gabot, thank you so much for joining us. So what have we seen just in the last week in Haiti? I know that this has been going on for a long time. There's so much unrest. What have we seen just in the last week?
I mean, what we are seeing is really catastrophic in nature. We are seeing what we call the lawlessness in a country where there is no government, there is no one to protect anyone. So everyone is left on their own while the gangs, you know, that are controlling the country. So, and we are also seeing a lack of support from the international community, because at this point, we are hoping to really hear, you know, like this sense of urgency that something needs to be done, like yesterday. And we are still not seeing that. This is very heartbroken.
Right. I mean, there's been since last year, I think, no democracy, right? There was a failed election. Before that, the president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated in 2021. Mm-hmm. Before that, and obviously COVID has hit Haiti very, very hard. Before that, there was an earthquake that was absolutely devastating, 220,000 people killed. People have said it sent Haiti into a humanitarian crisis. But all of that, just in the last decade or, you know, 14 years, that also has not happened in a vacuum. I mean, there was history and precedent that came before this to set this up. Can you talk about why, how that kind of folds into the call for Western humanitarian aid and help from other nations in addressing these kind of intersecting crises?
Yes. Yes, definitely, definitely. This situation, as we so many say, It's something that everyone predicted in a way, the infiltration of, U.S. government in Haiti, and the way that so often they are the one deciding on who needs to be in power and who cannot be in power. And once they are with somebody, whether or not the society, the community wants that person, they will just do whatever it takes to support that person. So, I mean, for years, they have not heard, our cry for fair democracy in Haiti. For years, they have not listened to any of the recommendations that we have been putting up front. And for years now, for the past 2 years, with those gang violence in Haiti, nothing has been done. So can you imagine a young boy who is 8 years old, 9 years old, cannot even eat, having this heavy, arm in his hands so that he can, save his life. So in a way, so many guns are in the street and nothing is being done about it. There is no police. There is no army. There is no structure whatsoever. So I think it's such like a pre-planned, destruction of a country for absolutely no reason, because we don't know why they want to destroy the country so badly. And that's what we are seeing every day, with no intervention, no support whatsoever. They do whatever they want. And that's the reason why we are in the situation that we are in now.
And we mentioned that the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, is stuck right now in Puerto Rico. No one can get in or out of Haiti. What is going on with that situation? I mean, when is he? I know he's trying desperately to get back home, but what would his plan be in terms of returning if there are no democratic leaders, there are no police, if there are gangs in the streets? What is he hoping to do once he arrives, if he can arrive?
I don't think that he can arrive. And I don't think that, from what we are seeing, from what we are hearing, we don't see, him going back. And especially that they already warned him, if he goes back to Haiti, there would be civil war. So again, going back will cause more harm than good. And I think also the U.S., the Biden administration should pay attention to all of the pleas of the Haitian community, not just in Haiti, but all around the world, telling the Biden administration to stop popping up a government that is not for the country. So currently people are stranding, they cannot travel. So imagine if you have an emergency that you need to be quickly transported here, you cannot do it. And it's not just, not being able to travel, not being able to access any care whatsoever, because everyone is afraid, everyone is hiding, everyone is trying to stay home until something is done. And that's what I'm calling for, this thing to be done, whatever it is, to reassure people that they can stay safely, they can live safely in Haiti, and they don't have to risk their lives going outside, fighting food, and then being killed. So something needs to be done, and that something needs to be done ASAP.
And we've spoken about this before in previous conversations, just about how Western governments, including the United States, including France, have a debt to Haiti because of a past of colonization and because of a past of, as you said, supporting and uplifting governments that ultimately, were to the debt. Can you sort of explain that?
Oh, yeah. For years, getting our independence was very costly. So we had to pay, to regain our independence. And since then, we are working just for the Western hemisphere, the government. They have not done anything to support Haiti. As a matter of fact, they have been taking everything that we have, even our natural resources. If they come, they don't come to help. They come to find out exactly what can they take. And that's the reason why we are in the position that where we are. A number of studies have shown, because we had to pay that debt toward France, that all the infrastructure that we were supposed to build, we could not do it because we didn't have the resources. And as of today, we are still paying, for something that we committed that we don't know what, whether or not, because we were the first free Black country in the world, that we have to pay so that we do not, encourage any other ones to be free. Whatever it is, we are paying a debt that is really costly to us and that we are paying as of today.
Yes, a debt from your own liberation.
Exactly.
Based in, here in Massachusetts, we have an incredibly large, one of the largest diasporas of Haitian Americans. What is it like for people in your community and here in Boston, in Massachusetts? Are you hearing from people back home? Are they concerned about the health and safety of their families? What's going on with that?
Every day we receive phone calls. What are we doing? Because everyone is afraid. I have my sister who still lives in Haiti. So can you imagine? We were supposed to meet this week, but she cannot travel. And we don't know exactly what the outcome is going to be for anybody, because at any given time, the gang can decide where they want to go. And even churches, like, you know, yesterday, they called me, some of the local churches in Haiti were dilapidated, you know, and burned down. So which means that everyone who is in Haiti right now, their lives are in danger. And everyone is so worried and concerned. And that's the reason why we are calling for this sense of urgency for us, you know, for the Biden administration to do something, you know, to at least protect lives. Because right now, they are dead in the street. Nobody can even go to remove them from the street. So that's how bad the situation is. Everyone is worried.
Your sister, I mean, what are you hearing from her? Is she able to get food? Is she constantly hearing gunshots? Is she afraid to leave her house? Does she feel safe in her house? What are you hearing from her?
Yeah, everyone is trying to really maximize whatever that they had left, because they cannot go out. And my sister, you know, being in Haiti right now, that's exactly what she's doing, trying to really make sure that whatever food that is left, that they take it, you know, slowly, so that they don't run out of food. Because if they run out of food, they are going to go to face anger or hunger. My sister, you know, is lucky, because she could have at least have food at home. But think about the million of people who have to eat on a daily basis. Every day they have to go out to find their food, because they cannot, you know, afford to have, you know, extra at home. So all of those people are, you know, staying inside, cannot go out. So thinking about hunger, thinking about people who are going to die because they cannot have access to any food. And that's how urgent the situation is right now. Pregnant women. So we heard from two families who said, you know, my cousins are pregnant and they need to deliver anytime soon. So what's going to happen when it's time for them to deliver their babies? So it's a huge humanitarian crisis that is really requesting, you know, an urgent intervention. So we cannot stay silent. We need to do something, and something now.
And it's affected, I think, Massachusetts, as you know, is the only right to shelter state, which guarantees families a roof over their head. You know, a lot of people, of newly arrived migrants have come from Haiti. But mm-hmm. with people unable to leave Haiti now, have you seen kind of a decline in those numbers? What are you seeing in terms of, I know that you work directly with people who've come in seeking shelter?
Yes. So basically, every time something is happening in Haiti, so we feel it directly here, okay? In the U.S. and for us here in the state, we feel it. Because right now, everyone, the only thing that they are thinking right now is as soon as they can leave, they will leave. You see what I mean? So in general, the people who are coming, they have been already on their way to come. So we still continue to see people coming. But for those who are now in Haiti, those who are like thinking, oh, maybe things are going to change, we can remain. After this, we know that so many of them will want to come to leave Haiti. Because again, who wants to risk your life when this is the way the situation is? Everyone, and we're going to feel it in the next few weeks or months, depending on when people can travel. We're going to feel it.
Yeah. Dr. Gerald Gabeau, thank you so much for joining us. Please keep us posted. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to America in Black. I'm CBS News congressional correspondent Nicole Killian. The race for the White House is coming into focus after Super Tuesday. The country appears to be headed toward a rematch between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. Just like in 2020, Black voters will play a critical role in the outcome of this election. More than 34 million African Americans are projected to be eligible to vote this year. And one of the largest blocks of Black voters is in Georgia. We travel to the battleground state to hear what people are thinking and feeling about the state of the presidential race in 2024. Johnny Daniel has been shaping up heads for more than a decade at Supreme's Barbershop in the heart of Henry County, Georgia.
It was mostly Republican, and then I think when Obama came in, it started to shift.
Which swung by more than 16 points for President Biden in 2020.
I want to thank you, the people of Georgia.
And helped Democrats flip the Peach State for the first time in nearly 30 years.
A
Why did you vote for President Biden in the last
because election? Of who he ran with, and he was in the White House for the 8 previous years. I felt like he had the experience, but definitively right now, I couldn't tell you that if they open the polls tomorrow, I'm voting for Joe Biden.
So what changed?
Life. The inflation and the things that we're going through right now. I want the right person so that I'm not paying $8 for eggs, $15 for gas.
Even though things may be improving economically, but you feel there's a disconnect.
Yeah, there is a disconnect. But the way these last 3 or 4 years have been, this is the worst it's ever been in my life. I never would have even considered thinking about voting for Donald Trump. But living in America these last 4, it's a consideration.
A consideration that's reflected in some polls. While 77% of likely black voters say they intend to support Mr. Biden, former President Trump leads Biden in several battleground states, including Georgia, where he lost by roughly 12,000 votes and faces charges of election interference.
That's why the black people like me, because they have been hurt so badly and discriminated against.
The politics are an ongoing debate between Azad Ahmadi, member of the Georgia Black Republicans, and his girlfriend Alexandra, a registered Democrat, who at times sit on opposite sides of the aisle.
So even though you have political differences, it's not a deal breaker.
No, it's not a deal breaker.
Oh, no, 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 absolutely not.
So in 2008 and 2012, you voted for?
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama.
2016.
I voted for Donald Trump.
Hillary Clinton.
2020.
Donald Trump.
Biden.
And who will you vote for in 2024?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
You may vote for the former president.
I may.
Why do you say that?
My views on certain things have changed. I am very much so riding the fence.
What are you struggling with?
Being in a pattern of doing the same thing that I've been doing, because it's kind of like second nature. Like, when you go in a poll, you hit Democrat. Something has to happen. I mean, it's just so expensive to survive. And we're planning on having kids. I don't want to live in a stressful environment trying to rub two pennies together to try to make it either.
When did you make that decision to check a different box?
Donald Trump's first term. I'm saying first term because I'm pretty sure he'll be in there. For a second term here soon. But in either case, post-Obama, I decided that the party just wasn't suitable to the goals that
I had. How did you come to that conclusion? Because at the end of the day, former President Obama was the first African-American president in history.
That's just
true.
I
mean, as a black man, I would assume that meant something.
Absolutely. You know, I attended the inauguration on his first term. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. in the 80s and 90s, came through the system as an institutional Democrat, went through a lot of the experiences that young black men go through, good and bad, ended up leaving that environment, grew up, started looking at the world through a new lens.
Black men are a coveted demographic for both parties. President Biden received 91% of the black vote in 2020. Former President Trump only got 8. But black men supported him at 3 times the rate of black women.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are investing a record $7 billion into HBCUs.
The Biden and Trump campaigns are also courting young voters who could be key, something that is not lost on these students at historically black Clark Atlanta University.
What is the most important issue to you in this election?
Austin Euler is a Democrat.
I think the biggest thing is start looking more in-house on our issues rather than always trying to be the world's savior.
Ajinkaya Sumas is an independent.
Protecting my rights as a black woman, my right to abortion, I don't think any man should have any say in what I choose to do with my body.
And Jacob Jones is a Republican.
If we can just take steps towards clearing our debt, I feel like it'll be a better nation, a better country.
How are you feeling about this election?
I don't know if you can see me sweating right now. It just, just feels like it's the same as last time, and you're really basically forced to vote between two older people.
You used the word forced.
Yeah, it does feel kind of forced. If you go back to the Trump era, there's always going to be something in the news. If you want to stick with the Biden era, you have to just deal with the fact that a lot of people already have a viewpoint on him. All the good things he's done, it's hard to change someone's mind.
As a younger voter, I don't want somebody who's many generations ahead of me, Biden being one of the oldest presidents, and he's fairly older. Same with Trump.
I think of President Biden, he kind of sold a dream that he couldn't accomplish. His famous quote was that for African American, you weren't black if you didn't vote for Joe Biden.
What do you think of former President Trump?
I think President Trump was a bad people's person, but a great leader. He put our economy in a booming state. He provided a permanent funding for all HBCUs.
This is also the same president who, when five minority young boys were arrested in New York for a crime they didn't even commit, said that we need to bring back the death penalty. So from a moral perspective, I can't agree or stand behind somebody when we have COVID-19 going around and you're calling it the Chinese flu.
How many of you think that there should be a third party ticket? All of you. Do you want to vote in this election?
Oh, yes. I'm still going to vote.
So you're not going to sit it out?
No. I'd never do that.
I feel like sitting out and not voting is basically staying quiet and mute. Our vote is our voice. Sitting out is just basically you're not doing a justice to yourself.
To help close any potential enthusiasm gaps, black churches are taking the lead. Aisha Brooks Johnson and Cassandra Morrow head the Black Church Collective, an organization that is also prioritizing voter education.
And you want to make sure you watch the same ballot accepted before you walk off.
After Georgia and several other states enacted new voting restrictions and redistricting maps.
Just like the old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it takes a village for every vote to count.
I think the black church should always be a place where it's safe, where you don't have to be embarrassed to say what you don't know.
We often hear that black women are the backbone, particularly of the Democratic Party. How do you perceive that?
I would say, you know, as black women, we're the backbone of almost everything.
I mean, what don't we care?
Exactly.
I mean, seriously.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
It's because of the burdens we carry, the weight we carry, and that we're seeing it through multiple lenses of oppression. Let's get these voices out here.
That's right.
For grassroots groups like Black Voters Matter, the outreach has been ongoing, kicking off the year in South Carolina for the first in the nation primary, a critical test of black support.
Are y'all excited about going to vote?
Yes.
Black people are in it. Like, we're in it to win it.
Latasha Brown is co-founder of the organization.
When I look at black South Carolinians, they actually got more of a vote share, particularly in Democratic primary, than their white counterparts, that literally that we showed up, even though all of the news was saying that we wouldn't show up, right?
Do you feel black voters are underestimated?
Oh, absolutely. You can't continue to take black voters for granted and think that all you have to do is emotionally rouse us, and then in some way that that's going to lead to a victory. We're beyond that. We want what everybody else wants. We want policies that are going to actually support and lift up our communities.
Some very interesting comments about voting in the election. I did notice, however, that they didn't mention third-party candidate Dr. Cornel West, nor was it brought up to any of the black males about Roe versus Wade. Very interesting comments, but we'll wait and see. And by the way, folks, yesterday, Tuesday, was the Georgia primary, and President Biden secured the Democratic nomination, as well as the former president securing the Republican nomination. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. We've got a few announcements, and we're out of here for Dan and Consolidation. You've been listening to Ebony Spectrum.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Medicaid and CHIP offer free or low-cost health coverage for children and teens. Hospital and doctor visits, prescriptions, shots, and more are covered. That's peace of mind for parents if a child is sick or gets injured. And parents may now be eligible for Medicaid too, even if they've applied in the past. Enrollment is always open. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Many medicines used to treat colds and flu contain acetaminophen, a pain reliever and fever reducer found in hundreds of over-the-counter and prescription medicines. But taking too much or more than one medication containing acetaminophen per day can damage your liver. So always read the label and don't take acetaminophen if you drink 3 or more alcoholic drinks every day. To learn more, visit fda.gov/OTC pain info. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Food and Drug Administration.
I urge you to tune in to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 on your FM dial. If you don't, I'll break both your legs.
You're listening to The Eli Show on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. You can listen online at WRCT.org, and you can reach us in the studio at 412-268-9728.
Welcome, everybody. We start with what is considered a big deal in the election projection sort of industry today, which is that 538 has published its first 2024 election projection, Trump versus Biden. And the results, can we call them stunning? Can we call them shocking? Can we call them surprising? I don't know where that noise came from. No, we really can't call them any of those things. We can call them corroborating of exactly what I've been laying out to you for months now. The 538 projection, who is favored to win the 2024 presidential election? 53 times out of 100 in simulations, Biden wins, 53 out of 100. And in 47 out of 100 simulations, Donald Trump wins. What this means is that it is a toss-up. What this means is that exactly what I have been saying, those who are confidently declaring that Biden obviously will win are not basing their projection in reality. Those who are confidently projecting that it is Donald Trump who will win are not basing their projection in reality, and that this is likely to come down to a relatively small number of votes in a small number of states. Now, let's dig into the simulation a little bit more deeply. As you can see here, there is a sort of distribution curve, and I'll describe what we're looking at for people who are only listening. There's a distribution curve of possible outcomes, and as you can see, they are really grouped right around the middle. You could make the case that there are more scenarios in which Trump wins. This isn't really an accurate interpretation of this model. What the model does suggest is that some of Trump's paths to 270 electoral votes include a larger margin of victory than some of Biden's. And that's by the very nature of which states are definitely going to go Biden and Trump and sort of the realities of that. If you're interested in seeing the full list of polls that 538 uses in making these projections, you can do that. It's not super relevant to our discussion today. One of the interesting things is where how has the forecast changed over time? Now, what's interesting about this is that they only just now are issuing their full projection, but you can back out some of this data. And what you can see if you go back is that there was a period where it seemed as though Biden was likely to come away with more electoral votes than he is right now. But the scenario that in this 53-47 margin, 538 says is the most likely right now is Biden 275 and Trump 263. Remember, 270 is the line between winning and losing. And so that is a very, very, very small margin, significantly smaller than it was in 2020. So if you're trying to figure out How important is it that I vote generically? Obviously, the truth is, because of the Electoral College, if you vote in California, it's less important that you vote than it is if you vote in North Carolina or even more Wisconsin or even more Arizona. We've talked about that, and that's part of why I'm against the Electoral College. But it is the system we have, and that's the one that we will be fighting this election over. But importantly, expecting a tighter electoral margin than in 2020. In terms of what are the critical toss-up states, they are, as I've been saying, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia. It is those five. And with those five, potentially hangs in the balance who will be the next president of the United States. What are the closest races? The closest ones, according to this model, are Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. All of those are under a 2-point margin. And then you get to larger margins. And then you can look at a whole bunch of other scenarios here. What's the takeaway here? There is one and only one takeaway, which is to pat me on the back and to say, you know what, David, you're right. This is probably going to be close. And I'm, of course, kidding. There's nothing particularly stunning or difficult about my prediction, which is elections in the United States, given the hyper-polarized nature.